The Tom Woods Show, episode 1673.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, by now you've probably noticed that news about the virus is almost always fact-free hysteria these days. So you need my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About the Lockdown. Go pick it up at wrongaboutlockdown.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here, joined today by Gad Saad, who is a Canadian evolutionary psychologist who teaches at Concordia University, and in addition to his scholarly work, has become known for being outspoken about, well, university culture these days and what life is like on the campuses, and it is not pretty. And he has built up quite a following and an audience for himself by making videos and doing podcasts and reaching the public to tell them what he's seeing on the ground in the universities. He's in Canada, but the situation is the same there as it is in the United States. So I have no doubt we're going to have a great conversation together. Gad Saad, welcome to the show.
Hey, so nice to be with you, Tom.
All right. I know you've written and talked quite a bit about consumer behavior, but these days I'm interested more in CEO behavior. I find that on the left, and by the way, I watched your video about why you criticize the left more than the right. It's because you're surrounded by these people 24 hours a day. They dominate the institution that you're in, so naturally you do talk about them. But what I find is a quite bizarre phenomenon on the left is that they portray themselves as being constantly under siege and being extraordinarily courageous taking the positions they take, even though everybody in Hollywood supports them. Every academic institution supports them. And whenever they latch onto a cause, every CEO feels compelled to write a letter to his email list and offer a 7, 8, or 9-figure donation. And that doesn't strike me as being under siege. So I'm curious about this phenomenon. Are they doing this, in your mind, just to cover themselves and protect themselves against the mob? Do they really believe this stuff? What do you think is going through their minds?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So let me start by telling you what they don't do and what would actually be impressive. So there's a phenomenon in biology called Zahavian signaling. The idea is that for a signal to be an honest one, it has to be costly. So take, for example, the peacock's tail. The reason why the peacock evolves a very burdensome tail that actually reduces its survivability, it's because it is selected through female mate choice, because that tail is saying, look at me, despite the fact that I have this very wasteful ornament that reduces my survivability, here I am, so choose me, I must be a good mate. So for a signal to be honest, it has to be handicapping. So a Saudi blogger like Raif Badawi, who blogs about Saudi culture while he is in Saudi Arabia, that's a Sahavian signal. And that has caused him to not be in prison for 6, 7 years. Whereas when a CEO, does the platitudinous, baloney, that doesn't take much of a Sahavian signal. And so I just dismiss all these guys as being empty virtue signalers.
I have a friend named Eric July, who is the lead vocalist for a metal band. He's also a rapper. He's black. And he takes unconventional views on things. And he was noting just over the past couple of weeks that he would see people in Hollywood and prominent cultural figures saying, now listen, I may lose contracts and gigs for this, but I'm going to come right out and say, I'm against police brutality. And Eric would say, what are you talking about? You're not going to lose anything for that. Why would you? You would lose anything if you said the opposite.
Exactly right. Listen, I heard yesterday from a black friend who wrote to me privately, so I won't mention the person's name. He's pretty prominent. And he basically was utterly confused. Again, he's a black gentleman, because his own family was beginning to disown him because they felt that he wasn't sufficiently down with the cause. And so literally, the purity test eats its own in an orgiastic self-cannibalism. And he literally didn't know what to make of it. So he was kind of reaching out to me, can you please help me, Gad? I can't make sense of what's happening in my family dynamics.
It must be crazy. It must be crazy. And even if, let's say, it's only a minority of black people who hold dissident views, it's not zero. it's still a substantial number, and they basically are treated as if they don't exist. Because
right. Well, I noticed in your Wikipedia page, I just want to kind of get a sense of, you know, some of your trajectory in life. And I noticed, I think, that Thomas Sowell is someone that you admire.
Yes.
What a white supremacist that guy, eh?
No. Now, that took some courage because, of course, it meant he was going to go through his life being accused of betraying his own people, which is not an easy thing to hear people say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, Larry Elder is another, right? The Sage of LA. Are you familiar with him?
Oh, sure, of course.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I admire so much people who are able to adhere to what they consider to be true, unencumbered by tribalism. And in a sense, if I may speak of my own reality, I mean, Tom, try to be an academic and have the big mouth that I have, right? I mean, I'm literally walking every single day, as you said about the clip that you watched of me. I am in the viper's den every day. But that's what angers me, because there's only one voice that's being heard and nobody ever, you know, speaks for the other side. And yet I receive thousands upon thousands of emails from professors, from students, from parents of students, all of whom write to me because, in a sense, they want to bear witness to the types of fears that they are experiencing because they're too afraid to say, well, you know, I might find something positive about Donald Trump, but they don't dare say it because they'll be ostracized in the most painful of ways.
Well, then let me ask you this. Sometimes you hear people at universities say, yes, certainly there is a dramatic disparity in the universities between people who think one way and think another way. Yes, there are an awful lot of left progressives at the universities, but the reason for that is not any sinister plot. It's we're smarter. They've said that.
I love that you just asked that question because I address exactly that point. Forgive me for the shameless plug in my forthcoming book, The Parasitic Mind. That's exactly what they say. I mean, professor, what are you complaining about? I mean, professors are smart. Therefore, obviously, they're going to be leftists because they're educated and smart. And then my rebuttal to that point, that very imbecilic point, is, look, there are certain issues that are incontrovertible facts. So, for example, that, you know, evolution at this point is something that, you know, unless you're an intelligent design kind of person, no serious scientist rejects evolution. But when it comes to most of the issues that are, you know, interesting to debate, is the death penalty good or not? What should be the fiscal policy of the United States, and so on? There are reasonable positions to take on either side. So the idea that there is sort of a truth and that therefore, since professors are smart, they should all hang on one side of the political aisle is insane, and it's idiotic and it's dogmatic.
Not to mention, in my experience, I generally know the other side's arguments pretty well. Jonathan Haidt, I'm sure you know.
He's been on my show.
Yeah, and mine too. And he's looked into this and said that people who are conservative, he was only looking at conservatives and liberals, and he was saying that conservatives tend to know liberal positions pretty well to the point where they could explain them to you and give the justifications for them. Whereas liberals really have no idea why conservatives think they do, probably because they're just shills for industry. Like, they can't think of any reason because they haven't really bothered to look. And so in my experience, when I am dealing with people who have spent their lives in academia, I know what they're going to say. They've never heard a word of the arguments that I make in return. They have no idea. So it's not that they've looked at both sides and evaluated them fairly and decided that the leftist one is correct. The leftist one, as far as they know, is the only position that a morally upright person could hold. So why should I bother reading anything else?
So true. You know, in one of the ending chapters of my book, chapter 7, I talk about how to seek truth. And in a sense, it speaks to your point. To seek truth, you really have to have a commitment to collect all of the relevant information that is necessary for you to arrive at a veridical position. And so I talk about something that I call nomological networks of cumulative evidence. So it's a fancy term, but let me try to break it down for you. So when you think of Charles Darwin, when he was developing the evidence or gathering the evidence for his theory, it took him several decades to do so using data from many, many different sources. So he didn't just run one experiment with his undergraduate students. He didn't administer one survey, but rather through the assiduous collection of endless sources of data, he built an insurmountable and incontrovertible, if you like, edifice of evidence. So when I walk into a room knowing that I'm going to be facing a very hostile crowd, so for example, in my scientific work, I apply evolutionary psychology in the behavioral sciences. Many social scientists hate biology, and so they're a priori very hostile to my ideas. But what I do is I present the evidence in such a, I mean, it's really a tsunami of evidence that it becomes difficult to then be hysterically, you know, against me because I just let the data speak for itself.
When is that book coming out, by the way?
October 6th.
Ah, okay. All right. Well, when October 6th rolls around, we'll try and get you back and talk.
Oh, that'd be great.
And don't in any way hesitate to plug anything. This half the show is I want to promote what my guests are doing, so it's no problem.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you.
So tell me, when exactly was it that you, in your academic career, went beyond, you know, your strict field into areas of current controversy? What was it that propelled you in that direction?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I guess it really started off when I was first exposed as a doctoral student to postmodernism. So already there, the gibberish that was being levied from all corners was really an affront to me, right? So already there, my cortisol levels were going up because I was getting pissed off. And as I entered academia and developed my career, I really saw just an endless number of places where these idea pathogens were destroying our commitment to reason, to logic. As I said, people could have very, very valid reasons as to why they are for or against the death penalty. And any reasonable person should be able to talk about both sides. On the other hand, when you, for example, in postmodernism, start with the position that there are no objective truths, well, that's a nihilistic position. That's intellectual terrorism. If there are no truths, then all scientists are really wasting their time waking up in the morning. So I got exposed to postmodernism in my academic career. I got exposed to radical feminism that denies biology and sex differences. You know, cultural relativism, who are we to judge the nefarious actions of another noble culture? And so for all of these various reasons, you know, I come from Lebanon where we escaped. We're Lebanese Jews. And we escaped the civil war in Lebanon. So that was the first war I experienced. The second war I experienced is the war on reason that I faced as an academic. And that's, if you'd like, what compelled me to start, you know, foraying into areas outside of my, you know, strict lines of expertise. Plus, I think I also am endowed, for better or worse, with a personality that, you know, is just offended by attacks on truth. I can't keep my mouth shut. My wife often complains and says, well, you'd have lower blood pressure if you just stop engaging everybody. Well, I can't not do it, Tom, because at the end of the day, when I go to bed and I put my head down on the pillow, if I feel that I haven't done whatever little or whatever much I can, I feel like a fraud and therefore I fight.
And what I find is that my blood pressure is even higher if I don't say something. Because it's making me crazy. Like there are people out there I should be answering. But heaven knows I spend much, much too much time, even though I've told people it's a waste of your time to be arguing on social media. Take that time and make YouTube videos that will reach a ton of people, not the 12 people watching that argument. Take the time to write on your blog, to work on your book. And I wish I would listen to my own advice. You know, what is the matter with me? Honestly.
If you ever crack that advice, please share it with me because I suffer from it, I think, much more than you do.
I saw a video you did where you said, it's my wife's birthday this weekend, so I promised her I'd be off social media. And I'm slightly breaking with this right now to make this video.
By the way, when I first made that announcement to show you the endless way by which people can be, you know, outraged, I had jokingly written, it's her 22nd birthday. Now, my wife and I have been together for 20 years. So if I do the math, that means I must have married her when she was 2. Or you could actually have a sense of humor and recognize that when I say that she's 22, I'm joking. Well, a whole bunch of cretins started writing to me and saying, you're disgusting. I'm unfollowing you. You're married to a 22-year-old, you pig. So, I mean, imagine... Right. You should be laughing because if it weren't so sad, it's hilarious.
Oh, that is ridiculous. Folks, let me take just a brief minute to tell you about the way I solve a major problem that we all have. Because we're all intellectuals, we have a pile of books we want to read. We have no idea how we're ever going to get through all of them. And the answer is Blinkist. It's unique and powerful, works on your phone, your tablet, your web browser. It gives you the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from over 3,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 categories. Blinkist condenses them down into blinks, which you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes. And I like Blinkist because after that 15-minute blink, I know whether or not the full-length audiobook is really a good use of my time. I use Blinkist when I'm driving around in the car, which would otherwise be dead time, and I'm absorbing book after book while I drive. I've listened to these blinks, and I highly recommend you check them out. Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker and The Doomsday Machine by Daniel Ellsberg. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership and up to 65% off audiobooks, yours to keep forever. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off a premium membership and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. Well, let's talk about, I actually don't know if Canadian universities such as the one where you teach, have tenure.
We do.
Okay, so you presumably yourself have tenure.
I do.
Okay, therefore, I don't feel so bad asking you this question. I'm not putting you in any jeopardy, but do you feel comfortable talking about your own personal experience at that university?
I do. So I mean, do you want me to start doing it, or are you asking specific questions?
Well, whatever you think is worth sharing with us about it.
Sure. Look, my university has been great in the sense that they've never intervened in the research that I do. So I'm very much of an interdisciplinarian, a polymath. I publish in medicine and economics and psychology in business journals. And they've never come and said, no, you have to publish in these few journals. So in that sense, they've given me complete freedom, as any good university should do. So in that sense, it's been great. In terms of my public engagement and my outspokenness, they've never come specifically and said, don't do this or don't do that. But I can assure you that I've noticed that it has become more painful for me to be there in the following sense. I used to hold a university-wide chaired professorship for 10 years, which should have been easily renewed given my CV, if I may say. It's now been 3 years that I've applied for it, and I didn't get it, and I suspect that I may never get it again. So there are subtle ways by which the university has taken a laissez-faire attitude towards me, where they don't come down on me. They don't, they don't in any way intervene, but it's as though they're distancing themselves. So I know, for example, many senior administrators who were big fans of mine. I mean, in 2015, I won the presidential award, so meaning given by the president of the university, for the professor who had the greatest global media impact. Well, since 2015 until now, if anything, my platform has grown exponentially, yet I was never again approached by the media department. So I could win the Nobel Prize tomorrow, Tom, and they won't announce it at my university. So it's in these subtle ways by which the university, if you'd like, is punishing me. But otherwise, my university, I mean, I can't complain. They've been truly great.
All right. Well, that is a nice thing to hear. Your name is going to be familiar to some of my listeners and new to others. So I'd like you to take a minute to tell us about your background. You hinted at some of it about your Lebanese background in particular that sounded rather interesting. So if you were to describe yourself in a couple of minutes and maybe in a way how it shaped who you are today, but at the very least, where you come from and what your life trajectory has been.
Sure. And actually, chapter one of my forthcoming book exactly answers that question, precisely because I wanted to tell people, what is my unique trajectory that led me to be the person that I am today? And so I was born in the 60s in Lebanon. We were part of the last wave of remaining Jews in Lebanon. So there was at one point a community, I think probably at its zenith, maybe about 20,000 Jews in Lebanon, but then it kept dwindling as the friction between the Arab states and Israel would increase. And so there'd be these sort of waves of, exodus out of Lebanon. And so we were part of the last remaining wave that had, in an obstinate way, decided to always stay in our homeland being Lebanon. And then in 1975, the civil war broke out, which, is probably still the benchmark by which all savagery is judged. The Lebanese civil war was absolutely brutal. and that it was endlessly tribal. I mean, everybody was fighting everybody else. And if you were Jewish, there weren't too many friends that you were likely to count on. These kinds of countries always have endemic, you know, Jew hatred. But in the context of Lebanon, it was certainly a tolerable, you know, thing to be Jewish. But then once the war broke out, it became impossible to be Jewish and we had to flee. And so we left Lebanon the first year of the Civil War, having already experienced quite a lot of horrible stuff. My parents subsequently in 1980, so after we had moved to Montreal in end of 1975, they kept going back to Lebanon because they actually had business that they had to kind of liquidate and so on. And on one of their return trips, they were kidnapped by Fatah. And I think they were held for 8 days. At the time, I was 15 years old. And luckily, through high connections that we had, you know, within within that network, we were able to, I say we, but I had nothing to do with freeing them. We were able to get them out. And then once 1980, they left, none of us ever went back to Lebanon, even though I've been invited by, you know, many, many folks to return to Lebanon now with guaranteed protection and all this. I've never felt comfortable going back. So then we moved to Montreal, grew up there, attended school in Montreal, and then went to pursue my PhD at Cornell. So now I'm moving from the personal to the academic, so I can give you a bit of both sides of my trajectories. And when I went to Cornell, the idea was to study consumer behavior, consumer psychology. And then in my first semester, I was assigned a book by a professor of social psychology. The book was called Homicide, which is written by two of the pioneers of evolutionary psychology, Martin Daly and Margot Wilson, where they look at patterns of criminality via an evolutionary lens. And that's the evolutionary bug that, you know, that bit me. And so I decided that I would, you know, spend my career, my academic career, incorporating evolutionary thinking in the study of decision-making and consumer behavior. So I don't know if I've given you enough of a background, but that gives you a bit of a sense of my background as a Lebanese Jew and as a budding academic.
Yeah, it absolutely does. In looking at your videos, it's not difficult to discern how you feel about academia these days, but I'm not sure I've seen anything where, and it could be I just haven't looked enough, but where you directly address your own political views. Do you ever discuss that?
I don't discuss it in the sense that, not because, oh, I'm trying to be shifty and coy. It's because I truly am a person of ideas. So what I mean by that is, if you ask me about the death penalty, you're going to think, so to use now the labels of the U.S. system, although I'm Canadian. So if you ask me about the death penalty, you're going to think I'm Republican. If you ask me about social issues, you're going to think I'm a Democrat. If you ask me about immigration, you're going to think I'm a hardline Republican. You follow what I mean, Tom? So it's hard for me to pigeonhole myself into calling myself X or Y or Z, because depending on the issue, I can be in radically different places. And so that's the reason why I seldom speak about my political views rather than my positions on specific issues, if
okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. You have a video called Decolonize Your Bookshelf that takes off on some of these ideas that we need to decolonize this or that. And by decolonize, I guess they mean, what, reduce the number of white men represented in various places. Can you make sense of this?
Yes. Now, you know, Tom, often what and I don't know how much you've watched my stuff, but I use satire and sarcasm as one of many tools of persuasion. And so what ends up happening oftentimes is my satire proves to be prophetic, because what I'm able to do is take a point of lunacy today and then extrapolate to the boundary condition of where this lunacy would take us. Then I satirize that boundary condition. And then if we wait 2, 3, 4 weeks or 4 months, then we end up at that position. So several years ago, so I'm going to come to your point about decolonize your bookshelf in a second. Several years ago, I had satirically announced on one of my clips that I was founding a new discipline called social justice mathematics. I have a background in mathematics. And so I started to satirize all the lunacy. So, for example, don't call something irrational numbers, which is an actual term for a type of number, because that marginalizes people who have mental health issues.
No one said that. That can't be.
Yes, sir. So, So I started, you know, just going down the whole list, satirizing all the stupidity. Well, what, you know, hold your breath for a year or two. Guess what? There's now a field called social justice mathematics.
No.
Math is a white colonial thing. You know, it's racist and so on. So decolonize your bookshelf is, if you'd like, an instantiation of that reflex, which is, you know, if you look at literature, it seems to be too many white guys. If you look at philosophy, it seems to be too many, you know, white guys. Newton, Darwin, all those bastards are white guys. You need to not only decolonize your shelf, Tom, you need to decolonize your mind, right? So science is only one of many ways of knowing, Tom, right? This is why there's the hashtag science must fall. There are many ways of knowing, of which the scientific method is only one way, and it shouldn't be privileged because obviously it was instituted or developed by white men. Now, I can also pray to my ancestral gods who are in the sky. That's an alternative way of knowing, Tom. Don't be racist, right? So, by the way, we see this. This is not just some esoteric academic exercise. We, in Canada, we're seeing what's called the indigenization of Canadian universities. I talk about this in the book. To indigenize your curriculum is to incorporate indigenous thinking into all your courses. Well, when I'm teaching evolutionary psychology, there isn't a Lebanese Jewish way of studying evolutionary psychology or a Muslim Somali way. So I don't need to indigenize anything. That's what liberates us when we follow the scientific method. Your identity doesn't matter, and yet now we're sinking back into the hole that we were in the Dark Ages.
You know, I feel like what I'm about to say is so conventional conservatism, Inc., but occasionally they get one right. And that is about diversity of perspective and diversity of opinion as opposed to diversity of skin color and stuff like that. But it is so overwhelmingly true that the insistence on making sure that the bean counters are satisfied and we have enough of this group and that group and that group, you can, but if the people in these groups don't hold the views that the patronizing overlords want them to hold, which is, by an interesting coincidence, the views they themselves hold, if they don't conform to that, then they're not really a member of that group. And so they've already decided in advance what everybody should think about everything. But as long as all these people with identical views come in different hues, this is supposed to satisfy our thirst for justice. It is worse than ever. It's like there's no acknowledgement at all that there is another point of view. I mean, I think this is part of the reason, again, that I think we have a group of people, particularly in academia, where they know their own position really well, but they could not explain where I'm coming from to save their lives. It's that they honestly have convinced themselves that it's not a matter of an honest disagreement over debatable topics, but they've dehumanized an entire group of people who themselves now live in a world where they're demonized, they're thought to be stupid and backward and a perspective that's not worth hearing. And yet the people who are doing this to them then proceed to gaslight them by calling them the oppressors. The average American is not in any position to oppress anybody, and he is bullied and lectured to all day long. I don't even know where I'm going with this. I just felt like I had to say.
No, you're venting, and I appreciate your frustration. Look, one of the benefits that I guess I come to these debates equipped with, and it's regrettable because it shouldn't matter, is I use the game of the what I call the die religion, the diversity, inclusion, and equity czars. I use all of their currency against them, right? Because I score very, very high in the oppression Olympics. I score very high in victimology poker, right? I am, quote, a brown Jew, right, from the Middle East. I'm an Arabic Jew who is a war refugee. So I'm going to outrank pretty much anybody who's going to be coming at me. And therefore, when I try to reason with them, so going back to your earlier point that they don't want to reason with you, if I try to reason with them with evidence, they don't listen. But if I then pull my Trump card, I know using the word Trump is going to trigger a lot of people. If I pull the Trump card of my victimology score on them, then they scurry away. So how regrettable is it, Tom, that it's not the strength of my arguments that defeats you. It's simply that I have a higher victimology score than you. It's grotesque.
If people want to follow your work, is your YouTube channel the best place to send them?
YouTube channel would be great. So if they just enter my name, Gad Saad, the show is called The Sad Truth, S-A-A-D. I started recently a podcast because many people were complaining that they don't want to just, you know, stream it on YouTube. And so I'm trying to now transfer all my content from my YouTube channel to my podcast. That show is called The Sad Truth with Dr. Sad. I added the with Dr. Sad because some thief actually took The Sad Truth, and I'm trying to take down his show. So you can follow me on podcast. You can follow me on YouTube. You can follow me on social media. I'm all over the place.
All right. That's excellent. I'll link to all these things that you just mentioned on our show notes page for today, tomwoods.com/1673. Well, the time absolutely flew as I knew it would, but I hope when your book comes out, we can do this again. And thanks so much.
I would love to. Thank you so much, Tom. That was great.
All right, folks, before I let you go, I want to tell you that if you're listening to this as it comes out, and that would be the week of, what is this, June 15th, 2020, I'm actually launching an information product this week. Because the old man here has been online for a long time with a website and videos and all the courses and stuff I do. And so I've learned how to drive traffic to things. That's the thing. You start your website and then tumbleweeds roll by. And that's very, very sad, isn't it? That is the number one reason people fail doing anything online, whether it's just to have a nice website or sell something or whatever, is that they can't get people over there. But the guy talking to you right now has tried it all. And I know what works and I know what doesn't. So I've taken what I've learned. And, you know, I'm a pretty good teacher, I have to say. That's one thing I'll say for myself. I'm a pretty good teacher. I've taken what I've learned, bundled it together into a product, the Traffic Academy. And I want you to check it out. So this particular week, it's ridiculously inexpensive. It's like nothing. It's embarrassing how inexpensive it is. We have it at this special launch pricing because this is the week of the launch of the product. So if you're hearing this in time, you can grab that while it's still at the launch pricing over at tomwoods.com/traffic. That's where you'll find Traffic Academy. I am very proud of this thing. You will be masters of the universe once you absorb this material. And no longer will tumbleweeds be rolling by before your website. So tomwoods.com/traffic is where to go for that. Tomorrow, who the heck am I having? Brian McClanahan to talk about the South. Seems like an opportune moment to do that. He'll be joining us tomorrow. Make sure you subscribe to the show, tomwoods.com/apple, and I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.